Good afternoon, and Chag Sameach. And what better way, as I said in the email, what better way to celebrate than by learning Ezra? So we are in Perek Zion. We are in Ezra chapter 7. We have been here for quite some time, cheating a little bit because Pesach was in between. But nonetheless, I actually do expect us to get through the seventh perek and even to start on the eighth today, because a lot of the background that we've done is going to make it smooth sailing for the rest. If you're using the Stone Tanakh, you want the top of page 1829, Perek Zion Pasuk Yud, chapter 7, sentence 10. By way of background, because why not? Our first week on Perek Zion, we spent talking about who Ezra is. What is the impact that Ezra makes on us? What do we know about his identity? Why was he staying in Bavel? We talked about the relationship between Yirmiyahu, Baruch ben Neriah, and Ezra. We talked about the roles that Ezra played, his identity as a sofer, and how there are different ways to translate the word sofer. The most literal, simple explanation of the word sofer, not meaning scribe, but rather meaning chacham. that he was knowledgeable, thank you, in the laws of Hashem. However, he's also taken as a sofer, as one who counts. And we talked about the counting of the letters within the Sefer Torah and different messages through that. And then we also talked about him as a sofer, as a scribe, in terms of the role that the Gemara talks about, in which he fixes the Sefer Torah and he also changes the way that we write Hebrew. We then started on the perek itself, on the chapter itself. We went through Ezra's great genealogy. We talked about his father, Sariah, who may have been Kohen Gadol, based on Malachim Bet. I put them on the back table. So if there are, that's where they are, because I need this one. We said he was described as a sofer mahir, which once again does not mean a fast scribe, but rather means that he is an able, knowledgeable chacham. Excuse me. And then we talked about the timing of his arrival. That was really the last thing that we spent time on, was the timing of Ezra's arrival in the land. How they depart. When do they depart from Bavel? Or when do they start their departure from Bavel, I should say? When do they begin their departure from Bavel? Feels like it's been more than a week, hasn't it? What? Right. The first of Nisan is the yahrzeit of Nadav and Avihu. Right? The first of Nisan was when they started their gathering, and that's also the first day of the Miluim, the dedication of the Mishkan, and that's the day when Nadav and Avihu, the sons of Aharon, the great-great-great-great, etc., uncles of Ezra, when they passed away. And then they actually leave on the 12th of Nisan. Really, who in the world leaves town on the 12th of Nisan? Yeah, like, really? You didn't just say, let's wait another 10 days? You know, we're gonna leave on the 12th of Nisan. Actually, somebody told me on Monday, I think he was talking about Rav Gigi from Gush, that in order to enforce that they should not enter Pesach with stress, they actually go away 3 days before Pesach and then come back home for Yantav. So that way all their preparation has to be done by the 10th or 11th of Nisan. They go away for those few days when, I'm told by Israelis, hotels are cheap. And then after that, they come back home and they have a nice, beautiful Yantav. I think that's great if you can do it. If you can manage your life that way, wow. Hatzlacha. But anyway, that they leave on the 12th of Nisan, and they arrive in Israel on the first day of Chodesh Av. The first day of the month of Av, and we noted the symbolism, first of all, because the Beis HaMikdash, the first temple, had been destroyed in the beginning of Av, and then second, because that's the yahrzeit of Aharon HaKohen. So that here we are with Ezra, the descendant of Aharon, and he arrives in the land on the yahrzeit of Aharon, and of course we noted as well the Chidah, who claims a line of Gilgul, a line of reincarnation, in which it's Aharon, Eli, and then Ezra. Okay, so we had a lot of fun. That brings us to Pasuk Yud, sentence 10, the last bit about Ezra's mission. Look at what the Pasuk says Ezra is here to do. Again, if you're using the Stone Tanakh, you want the top of page 1829. V'ze parshegen hanishtivan, asher nasan ham... Oh, sorry, that's pasuk Yud Aleph. Yud. Ki Ezra hechin levavo lidrosh es taras Hashem v'la'asos ul'lamed b'Yisrael chok u'mishpat. Ezra set his heart to learn the Torah of Hashem, to practice it, ul'lamed b'Yisrael chok u'mishpat, and to teach in Israel the laws of Hashem. You notice the phrase chok u'mishpat. So chok and mishpat are often like peanut butter and jelly. Like they get referenced together. When you go all the way back to the Jews at Mara, the first place where we are told the Jews learn Torah after they leave Egypt, Sham Samlo Chok Umishpat Visham Nisahu. There, the Jews receive Chok and Mishpat, and there's discussion in the Medrash exactly what they learned on that site. But that phrase, Chok Umishpat, is a very important phrase. If you take a look on your sheets, it's source number one, Gemara in Sanhedrin. And this is very important as we piece together Ezra's identity and what he means for us. So last time we connected him to Aharon HaKohen HaRosh. This time we compare him to Moshe. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Ro'i Haya Ezra Shatinase Torah Al Yadoli Yisrael. Ezra was so great that he would have been worthy of presenting the Torah to the Jewish people. Except, Imalei Kodmo Moshe. Moshe got there first. Where in the world do you get this idea from? I mean, we know that Ezra's groundbreaking, and we're going to see all the things that he accomplishes. But why Ezra and Moshe in particular? So it's scriptural association. We have psukim that are associated. But Moshe hu omer, Moshe Allah, el ha'elokim. When Moshe gets the Torah, it says, and Moshe went up to Hashem. Be Ezra hu omer, hu Ezra alami Bavel. He, Ezra, ascended from Bavel. So what? Ma aliyah ha'amur kan Torah, just like the ascending that Moshe did was to get the Torah, af aliyah ha'amur lahalan Torah. So to the later one, the one with Ezra, is about Torah. I want to come back to that. I just want to finish the source first. B'Moshe hu omer, v'osit siva Hashem ba'es hahi, l'lameid eschem chukim u'mishpatim. With Moshe, it says, Hashem told me at that time to teach you chukim u'mishpatim. There's that chok and mishpat. I translate it as laws and statutes, which is as good as anything. Be'ezra hu omer ki Ezra hechin levavo lidrosh es taras Hashem v'la'asos ulamed b'Yisrael chok u'mishpat. That Ezra's goal was to teach in Israel chok and mishpat. Ve'av al pishlo nitna Torah yado nishtan al yado aksav. And then it continues to say, as we've already discussed somewhat, that the even if the Torah is not given by him, nonetheless, he changes the way that we write Torah. Tell me something. Are Moshe and Ezra the only ones to ascend somewhere in Tanakh? Of course not. Right? Who else ascended in Tanakh? Anybody? Well, Eliyahu, he really ascended. Right. No shoes required for that one.
Going up to Israel.
Right. The Meraglim, they ascended. Vayalu Banegev. I don't think we mean to connect them to Moshe or to Ezra. So what in the world are we doing here? What we're doing is we're trying to say that their goals were the same. Meaning, when it says regarding Moshe, Moshe Allah El Ha'elokim, and Ezra Allah Mibavel, what we're trying to say is not simply that here are two people for whom it says they went up, but rather, what we know about them is that Moshe goes up to get the Torah. That's the specific reason why he's going up Har Sinai. And that with Ezra, the end of the pasuk is going to say, he went up, why? In order to lamed chok u'mishpat, to teach chok and mishpat. All it's trying to do is to show us the identity of their goals, to say that they want to accomplish the same thing, and that is what makes the association and says, had Moshe not been there, had Ezra been there back in the day, so that's what he would have done. Instead of coming to Israel to teach you Chok and Mishpat, he would have done it a much easier way. He would have done it, well, I don't know if it's easier at all. He would have done it at Har Sinai. Let me hold off on that easier part until I try them both out. Yeah?
What is the significance and the motivation of Ezra seeming to have the chutzpah
to change the font that Moshe Rabbeinu used.
Right. So that's the part that I deliberately skipped when we discussed a little bit about his role, and I mentioned that the Gemara says that he changes the script. It's a really interesting question. We did say that he changes the script. A recap for anyone who wasn't here, the Gemara says explicitly that before the time of Ezra, we are using the script that is today called Paleo-Semitic. It's a script that has letters that match our letters. There are no phonemes that are missing, you know, letters in our alphabet that reflect sounds that aren't in that alphabet, but the letters are written differently than the ones that we have now. And we know this, meaning if you look at Samaritan writings, you can see it. As a matter of fact, if you look at some of the scrolls that are found, you find that they're written in the Assyrian alphabet, which is what we have. However, the name of Hashem, where it appears, is written in Paleo-Semitic, is written in that older one. I think if I remember correctly, the one shekel coin has the word shekel written, shin kuf lamed, in this older script. As I'm talking, I'm also stalling as I try to remember why Ezra changed it, because I had seen a couple of ideas for why he changed it, but I'm blanking right now, so I'm going to have to, I'll have to email everybody out afterwards and let you know, because I don't remember offhand. I had seen a couple of nice ideas, too. Okay. Homework. But Ezra is credited with making that change. Okay. Yeah.
But I think we're fine with similarities because Ezra is, because we're trying to find a similarity. He's similar to Moshe in terms of his role. His role is not just teacher, leader. I mean, and it's a unique role in our history. Many people like that. So it's very obvious that they would make this.
Right. And to do it in such a groundbreaking way. I mean, we have other figures who are credited with groundbreaking teaching of Torah. I think it's Rabbi Yehuda ben Becerra in the Gemara, who's credited in the times of the Romans with restarting Torah. Rabbi Akiva, of course, after the death of everyone, basically. You're talking about 24,000 students or pairs of students. And then he restarts with the five who happen to be the founders of our basic bodies of Medrash. Meaning all those people, you have to realize that there are a few different lists of who the new students of Rabbi Akiva were, but these are the ones who are credited with writing Sifra, Sifri, Mechilta, and so on. They're the ones who create Torah Shebaal Peh, and it's all coming from Rabbi Akiva. So there have been others, I guess, who you could sort of put this
way. And if Rabbi Akiva's, if the Bar Kokhba rebellion had been successful, we might have seen him as that total leader.
Interesting. It's an interesting point.
Right.
And Rabbi Akiva actually is another one who we link with Moshe, right? When we talk about the Gemara in which Hashem shows Moshe the classroom of Rabbi Akiva, right? And Rabbi Akiva is put into that kind of a role. It'll be interesting to do a study of who exactly gets on this rather great list. Yeah, nice list to be on. Okay, so this is Ezra's mission. By the way, worth noting, Rashi notes the opening word in Pasuk Yud. Rashi connects it back to the preceding Pasuk, meaning the word ki in general in Sefer Ezra is often just like an emphasis word. However, here they read it as because. The preceding Pasuk talked about how he succeeded. Ki yad Elokav hatova alav, right? Hashem's benevolent hand. Why was Hashem benevolent him? Why did Hashem help him? Ki Ezra hechin levavo, because he set his heart to do this. That's why Hashem made him a success. Okay. So, to sum up what we've seen now, Ezra is on his way. He has actually even arrived, although we're now going to backtrack onto the journey itself. It is interesting to contrast this group with the initial group, in the sense that the initial group came for one purpose. Which was? To build the Beis HaMikdash. That was the mission of the first group. They laid the groundwork. And then the second group brought Torah. Right? The first group is not Ezra's group. There are people of Torah. Haggai and Zechariah are there. You can't get much better than that. Zerubbabel is a person of Torah as well. But it's very interesting in terms of the first group laying the groundwork, establishing their cities, building the Beis HaMikdash, and then Ezra's going to come in with the Torah. Okay. So let's take a look at the next section here. Starting with Pasuk Yud Aleph, we get the decree of Artachshasta. Artachshasta, who might be Daryavesh, who the Malbim even thinks might be Koresh, according to, he thinks that's what the Gemara is saying. Note, we are going back to Aramaic for this decree. So those who enjoyed our brief sojourn in Hebrew, it'll come back. Pasuk Yud Aleph. V'zeh parshegen hanishtivan. This is the text of the decree, asher nasan hamelech artachshasta le'ezra kohen asofer, which Artachshasta gave to Ezra the Kohen, the Chacham, sofer divrei mitzvos Hashem v'chukav al Yisrael. He is the teacher of, you can say scribe if you like, the words of the mitzvos of Hashem and his laws for Israel. So this is what this is what Artachshasta wrote. Artachshasta melech malchaya la Ezra chahana safar dasa dialaka shemaya gemir uch enes. Right, Artachshasta, king of kings, to Ezra the Kohen, the sage of the law of the God of heaven. We've seen the Persian kings calling Hashem the God of heaven since the beginning of the book. Gemir. What did we say Gemir means when it shows up in a letter? Etc. Gemir is Vigomer. Etc. The Ucheenes, and Ucheenes can either refer to a place or it means and now, like the word Ke'an in Aramaic. Mini sim te'em. The order goes forth from me. Dichom is nadav b'malchusi min ama Yisrael v'chahanohi v'leivaye l'mahach l'Yerushalayim imach yehach. Here's my order. Anybody who volunteers in my entire empire, from the nation of Israel, from its Kohanim, from its Levium, to go to Yerushalayim with you, shall go. Permission is granted. That's interesting. Why is permission needed? Why do you need permission to go? It's you're staying in the empire, still in the tax base. What's the big deal?
You're going to take sure that you're not there for rebellion or something else.
To show that they're safe, that it's not viewed as rebellious potentially. Okay, yeah.
The first order has been finished.
Yeah.
You're allowed to go. That's the first.
Right. So
you're asking for something different.
I'm inclined to read it that way as well, and it's not just me. Malbim is actually going to say it. Did I bring it on the sheet? I did. If you take a look at Malbim, source number 2, he says, "Mipnei shebepikudah rishona shenasan koresh rishus livnei agolal aleches liyushalayim be'er hatam shukdei livnos sham es beis Hashem." And the first order, when Cyrus let everybody go to Yerushalayim, he said it's in order to build the Beis Hamikdash. So that means the order is done. You built the Beis HaMikdash. That's complete. Your exiles, granted that your land is also in the empire, you don't get to move back to the land from which you were exiled without government order. Apparently that's the way it's done. Lachain and Nasan Rishus Mechadash, so he gave new permission. Shekomim ibn Yisrael Shinis Nadev Latseis Imach Yeshlem Rishus Laleches. That anybody who wants to go may go, and the reason why you may need it is possibly because this is a statement of you're not rebelling, you're making what is considered a legitimate move. Okay, good. Keep on reading. Let's see what else we have here. Kol kavel dimin kadam malka v'shivas ya'atohi shaliach levakara al Yehud v'lirushalem bedas elakach di vidach. He says, why is this? Because permission is given from the king and from his 7 advisors for you to go levaker, levakara, right? What does bikur mean? With a kuf? Sorry? No. Haha, that was why I asked the question. Bikur cholim does not mean visiting the sick. Bikur cholim means examining the sick. As the Gemara in Brachos says, the goal of bikur cholim is twofold. One is for the visitor to be moved by what they see to daven to Hashem on behalf of the person who is sick, and the other is to look after the needs of the patient. The Gemara in the beginning of Brachos talks about the sages, I think Rabbi Akiva was one, Rabbi Yochanan was another one, who visited people who were sick in order to see what do they need. And they would sweep up the house and they would open the window, whatever it was that was the need of the patient. Bikur cholim is supposed to be to examine, not to visit. Lachzos benoam Hashem ulevaker behechalo doesn't mean I'd like to visit the Beis HaMikdash. It's a more serious endeavor.
But we usually have the word bochein
v'china. Yeah. I'm not bothered by synonyms. I mean, they're not really synonyms. I think you could make a distinction between levaker and lechon. That doesn't bother me so much. But levaker is used throughout Chumash, really. It's not a new word in Navi.
So when Hashem came to visit Abraham on the third day, that was not beautiful.
Why isn't it Hashem looking after his needs? Happens to be his needs are to have guests. I'm okay with that. Okay, so they are sent Livakara to examine Yehuda and Yerushalayim bedas elakach dividach by the law of your God which you have with you. Ulehevala ksaf udahav dimalka viatawi hisnadavu lelaka Yisrael dibirushleim mishkenei. And that's not your only job. Your job is also to bring the silver and gold of the king and his advisors, which they have donated to the God of Israel, who lives in Yerushalayim. And that's not it. And all the silver and gold found in Bavel, im hisnadavus ama v'chahanaya misnadvin leves elakahom di Yerushalayim, whatever the nation and the Kohanim volunteer for the house of their God in Yerushalayim. Someone's generous today. Right? So what exactly is Ezra's job as far as Artaxasta is concerned? What exactly is on the list of his jobs?
Big salaries.
Well, bringing the money anyway. What else?
To investigate
and see how things are going. Sacrifice has not been mentioned yet. It will be. To look after the Jews and their religion, to bring the money and the purchased materials for the needs of the Beis HaMikdash. That's what Ezra is here to do. Note, by the way, how many advisors does he have?
Seven
advisors. Who else had seven advisors?
Achashverosh.
Shivas Sarei Parasu Madai. It's not a coincidence. He's a Persian king also. But this is apparently Persian government structure, is that you have the seven. Not unlike in Daniel, where we saw certain kings had three and this one had 120. Like there were certain structures that they used in their reign. Okay, but we're not done. But wait, there's more. Pasuk Yud Zion, sentence 17. Kol kavel dina asparna tikne bechaspa dina torin dichrin imrinu min chashon v'niskehon uskarev himo amad b'cha divez alakachom di birushleim. So he says, therefore, you know what you should do? Quickly, he says. Notice the emphasis. Asparna, quickly. We've seen that word before. Quickly, you shall purchase with this silver. You shall purchase oxen, right? Torin, shorim in Hebrew. Dichrin are rams. Imrin are sheep. Menachos are flour offerings, usually. As well as niskehon, the nesachim, the libations, wine and oil that you pour on the Mizbeach, and you shall bring them on the altar of your God in Yerushalayim. Umad yalach v'alechach yetav bishar kaspa v'dava lemebad, and whatever you and your brethren want to do with the rest of the silver and gold, kirus alakachom, in whatever is the will of your God, ta'avdun, so you shall do. Not bad. But he's not done. Pasuk Yotes, sentence 19. Umanaya dimisyavin lach, the vessels that have been given to you, lafalchan beis elakach, for the worship of the house of your God, hashleim, either complete them or bring them forth completely, use all of them, kadam alaka Yerushalayim, before the God in Jerusalem. Ushar chashchus beis elakach diyipel lach lemintan, and whatever else is missing from the house of your God that falls to you to give, tintain min beis ginze malka, give it from the stores of the king. Missing anything? I don't know, brass doorknobs? Whatever it is, you can take that from the royal supply. This is very impressive, but believe it or not, he's still not done. Pasuk Chaf Aleph. Umini ana artachshasta malka, and from me, I, double me, the artachshasta the king, sim to aim, the order is given, l'chol gizavraya di ba'avar nara, to all the gizbarim. What's a gizbar? Anybody know?
Treasurer.
Treasurer, an officer who's in charge. To all the officers who are in charge of the treasuries on that side of the Jordan, meaning Israel, if you're from Persia, right? This is the other side of the Jordan. Anything that Ezra the Kohen, the sage of the laws of the God of heaven, anything he asks of you, Asparna Yisavid, should be done immediately. Ad Ksaf Kakrin Ma'an. Now he gets down to numbers. He says, silver, up to 100 kikar of silver. Ve'archintin Karin Ma'ah, up to 100 kur of wheat. Ve'ad chamar batin ma'ah, up to 100 bat of wine. Ve'ad batin mishach ma'ah, and up to 100 bat of oil. Umalach, dilak sav, and salt, unlimited. Not even recorded here. All that. Kol di mintam elaka shemaya yisaved as darza leves elaka shemaya. All this, by the order of the God of heaven, shall be done as darza. What word in Hebrew does as darza sound like? Zariz, sorry? Zariz, rizud, zrizin. Energetically, it shall be done. There's another way to take it also, we'll come back to in a minute, or a few minutes. But it should be done quickly, energetically, for the house of God of heaven. Dilamala hevek tzaf, amalchus malka uvnohi. Because why should there be anger against the empire of the king and his children? Sound familiar? We saw this before when we talked about Darius's order as well. He said, you should daven for me and for my children. So Artaxasta says, clearly his hope is that this will be done and it will put himself and his family in good stead with this Elaka Shemaya, God of the heavens. But he's still not done. He has more coming. Maybe I'll pause there because there's a lot we've already said. Excuse me. He gives this permission for them to go along with Ezra for the two missions of looking after the Jews and their religion, as well as bringing funding. And he gives the order for his officers to give whatever they deem necessary. But here's an interesting turn of phrase. Up to 100 kikar of silver. What if they ask for 101? No, right? This is, you know, I mean, 100 kikar of silver sounds nice. We're going to find out just how nice it is soon. It is rather generous. But I think we have to ask ourselves, because when we go back to Darius, there were no numbers mentioned. When Darius gave his order for what they could take, he just said take, and he listed a whole bunch of substances. He did not say up to any limit. So why is it? It was in Perek Vav. It was in chapter 6 that we saw Darius's order. Why did we get a limit here? So let's go back to the initial question, which we've asked before. We asked it regarding Darius. Why is Artaxasta being so wonderful to the Jews? We asked it going all the way back to Cyrus, right? And we said Cyrus's policy was not just for us. Cyrus's policy was for the nations he conquered. He said it's a lot easier to deal with a population you've conquered if they think you're their friend, right? They're not constantly trying to rebel. So give them what they want. Let them worship their God. It doesn't hurt me. They're paying taxes and they're not rebelling. I'm good with that. And they did it to the Babylonians. And he did it to us, at least. Those are the ones that we have specific knowledge of. So we asked then, what is this? Is it really just a practical generosity? So maybe. We also saw, though, regarding Darius, Perek Vav Pasuk Chafet, chapter 6, sentence 22, in which we were told that the Jews celebrated Pesach with great joy because Hashem had turned the heart of the king to be generous to them. So that the pasuk seems to be saying, credit it to God, right? Credit it to Hashem. It's Hashem has made the king help us out. The challenge with that is that we also saw the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah. And the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah assumes that the king is acting independently, both for good and for bad. Do you remember we learned the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah that asked the question of why the king said, pray for me and my family, right? And it suggested that that was actually a negative motivation, right? We were here for this. The Gemara said that we look at it as a sign that maybe he was selfish in what he was doing. So I think we need to ask ourselves, accepting, because we do, that the text says that Hashem has made him help us, you still have to ask yourself, okay, but what is he thinking? What is the king thinking? When Darius, Artaxasta, one and the same perhaps, say, Jews, you may have this. It's not like he's been brainwashed and he doesn't actually have any awareness of reality and he's writing an order and then he wakes up the next day and say, wow, what happened yesterday? He thinks that he's doing it for a reason, for a practical reason, maybe the pragmatic reason of helping himself govern, but he thinks he's doing it for a reason. It's like, we've discussed this before, Sefer Shoftim, nations do all sorts of things, but only once in the entire book are we told what the nations are thinking, right? Only when Amon says, we are coming to attack the Jews because the Jews took our land when they entered from Mitzrayim. Other than that, Midian, Moab, and all of them, they all Plishtim, they all think that they're doing something in their own interests, but it happens to be Hashem is manipulating them to come punish the Jews because the Jews haven't done what they were supposed to do, theme of Sefer Shoftim. So to here, there has to be something that a king is thinking, even if he's being manipulated. So the question is, what is it that is in his head? So you could say, again, that it's a practical move, that it's a pragmatic move. But I think, and the Da'at Mikra supports this idea, that there's something else going on which is going to be important in understanding the magnanimity of Artaxasta. He's converting the temple, the Beis HaMikdash, from a private religious institution into a government institution. He has co-opted the Beis HaMikdash. If you think of what the Samaritans may have been trying to do, when we talked about the Samaritans saying, let's build it together, and there was the feeling as brought in Malbim that maybe the Samaritans wanted to convert it to be their idolatrous structure, what the king has done is he's taken what we viewed as our national religious building and he's now made it the Persian national religious building. It now has his name on it, right? Dedicating the Beis HaMikdash. It's actually a very clever move. Ezra is now not only Ezra HaSofer, Ezra HaKohen, he's also Ezra representative of King Artaxasta, who is there and is paid and fully funded by the government. And that explains a lot of what happens between Artaxasta and Ezra. We didn't get to it yet. We're about to. He's going to give Ezra unbelievable rights and powers. The sort of thing that, no, you don't normally give away to somebody from your captured minority population. You'll see. It's really very strange. Also, yeah?
He does limit him to Judah. Not Judah and Samaria.
Correct. He's not trying to torture the Samaritans. This is true.
Yeah. And he limits
even separation.
Correct.
He does give him a budget.
And he gives him, well, we're going to come back to what he did with the budget, because that's a good question, but so it appears.
In the actual details, like,
you mean, like, giving numbers?
Yeah.
Yes.
He's really in there.
Yes.
Doesn't he have anything else to do? Yeah.
Maybe not. It's a slow day in Persia. I mean, it becomes a lot slower if his people like him. You know, he's not putting down rebellions. The earlier period, we saw that. With Darius, he's dealing with revolts. I don't think Artaxasta is facing the same problem in this time of Ezra. There's also something else here that's very interesting about the text of the decree. Go back for a second, please, to Pasuk Yud Gimel, sentence 13. He didn't say, everybody gets to go. He said, everybody gets to go, imach, with you. Right? It's about Ezra personally. And all through the decree, the emphasis is on you, Ezra. Whatever you decide, based on your knowledge, based on what God tells you, it's very Ezra-specific. Why? Because Ezra is effectively representing the government. He's effectively representing the empire. So therefore, it's all going to be about Ezra personally, and you'll see it very strongly with the rights that Ezra gets. Now, to come back to this business of the limit on what he can spend. So take a look on your sheet, please, at source number 3. You will recall, hopefully without pain, but not for me, with pain, the time that we spend trying to figure out whether kings start their calculations from Nisan or start their calculations from Tishrei, right? By the way, someone asked the question last time about that Malbim. I forgot I was going to start with this. We were trying to figure out why it said twice, year 7 of Artaxasta, and Malbim had given the answer that Artaxasta started his reign on the 2nd of Nisan. So when it said the 1st of Nisan, it was the end of his 7th year. So someone asked the question last time that actually Artaxasta, the kings start on the 1st of Nisan. What do you mean, the 2nd of Nisan? So I looked back in the Malbim and he actually answered that question. Malbim's answer was, we meant personally. Whatever they're doing royally on the documents is from the 1st of Nisan. But Artaxasta knew, I started on the 2nd of Nisan. And therefore, that latter mention was the conclusion of the year. That's a side note from last time. But the Gemara itself came up with the idea that because the year didn't turn over when we expected it to for this king who may be Koresh, Daryavish, or Artaxasta, meaning that at first in his career, it seemed like there was a new year when you hit Rosh Chodesh Nisan. But then, later in his career, the new year seems to begin in Tishrei. And the Gemara needed to solve that problem. And it suggested that it was because he went bad. And the Gemara then asked, well, how do you know he went bad? And we gave one answer. We said it was because he said, pray for me. And that showed he was doing it selfishly. We gave a second answer as well. There's a third answer, which we are going to see when we get to Nehemiah, actually. We're not there yet. But then the Gemara brings a fourth answer in source number 3 to try to explain. Thank you so much. The Gemara brings a fourth answer, and that's in source number 3. How do I know that this king went bad? Ibayis Ema, if you want, I'll tell you. Minoan da Achmitz, how do we know that he went bad? Mehacha, from the following pasuk. It's the pasuk we just read. We can skim through it, right? Up to 100 kikar of silver, up to 100 kur of wheat, up to 100 bat of wine, up to 100 bat of oil, and unlimited salt. Meikara belo kitzusa. Initially, in chapter 6, there was no limit. Vahashta bekitzusa. Now there is a limit. But the Gemara says, v'dilma meikara lo havakamle bekitzusa. Maybe that's not why he changed. Maybe he always meant there to be a limit. But in chapter 6, we had no way of knowing what was going to be needed, so he didn't set a limit. Chapter 7, now he has a better sense of it. The Beis HaMikdash is up and running. And so he says, this is the limit. So the Gemara says, yeah, I can't prove anything from this. Don't prove anything from it. Maybe it was a utilitarian thing, not representative of a shift. The other view, though, is Mitzudat David, Rabbi David Altshuler, in source number 4, where he doesn't seem to view it as a limit at all. He reads it as, Af im yar belish ol ad kuf kikar kesef ve'ad kuf kurim chitim, etc. Even if he asks for 100 kikar, give it to him. Even if he asks for whatever, 100 kur, give it to him. That's the way that Mitzudat David reads the line, and it's not a limit at all. What is particularly interesting is something that the Da Mikra edition points out, and that's in source number 5 from Herodotus. Now, I'm not going to read out for you the entire piece. I thought I brought I brought a larger part than I needed just because I thought it was interesting. But the key point is actually what's at the end. It's talking about the different provinces, and where the Jews were was the 5th province of the empire. So the 5th province, it's the last paragraph in number 5, was the country, except the part belonging to the Arabians, which paid no tribute, between Poseidon, a city founded on the, I'm going to guess, Cilician, but I don't actually know. Anybody know? Ha, then it's Cilician. Okay. And Syrian border, by other people whose names are hard to pronounce, and Egypt. This paid 350 talents. In this province was all Phoenicia and a part of Syria called Palestine and Cyprus. The key is the 350 talents, which according to Dat Mikra translates to 300 silver kikar. That's very important because you just told me that Ezra is allowed up to 100 silver kikar a year. Even if I take that as a limit, that's 1/3 of the local tax base is going to go for the Beis HaMikdash. That's a wild number. What it suggests is that that this is some level of exaggeration on his part, saying sort of like, you know, one way to understand Ahasuerus to Esther, up to half my kingdom. He doesn't expect her to ask for half the kingdom. Whatever you like, up to half the kingdom is yours. Why he felt the need to say up to half is another discussion. But the point is that that it's a crazy number. 100 kikar of silver is... Don't do that. Don't do that. I don't want him. I don't want him here. Okay. They and certainly not compared to Hatach Shasta. I'm sorry. Okay. So what we have is this great gift that he's giving, perhaps because he has nationalized the Beis HaMikdash, perhaps because he wants them to pray on behalf of his family, and he says it should all be done as darza, which I explained initially means energetically, with alacrity. But Malbim says there's something different. If you take a look at source number 6 on the flip side of the sheet, he says, Adrazda chosam balashon aravi. He gives you a similar word, which he says means a seal in Arabic. I did look into this in Arabic. I was not able to find this word, but that's not so surprising. You'd have to have a better knowledge of Arabic than mine. But he says it means a seal, which adds another dimension to what Hatach Shasta is doing, as Malbim goes on to explain. He commanded that Ezra should prepare a seal. Inscribed upon the seal should be the seal of the house of God. Anything emerging from the Beis HaMikdash, yuchtam b'chosam, should be sealed with that. It would have the status of a decree of the God of heaven. Just like something sealed with the royal seal is the royal decree. That is a remarkable splendor for the house of God. It has the power to issue its own royal orders, so to speak. And it will be with the force of that which the king orders. Again, showing what he's done with the Beis HaMikdash, that it's part of the royal structure, but he's giving it its own standing. Very interesting thing. But as I said, he's not done. Shana.
It's interesting to me that Malbim says this, because for us, I would see this as, so to speak, a step down for God.
Yeah.
And this is kind of limiting, as it were, God's powers. And I think of Malbim as being a very astute political commentator, and he's not seeing this, or at least he doesn't seem to see this here. Mm-hmm.
I guess it all depends on what your baseline is, right? Meaning, if you're starting out as, we are an exiled, impoverished population far from our land, and the king has just said that our shul gets to issue orders and call them royal orders, we feel pretty good. As opposed to, you know, we're already in our land, we have a Beis HaMikdash, and now the king is co-opting us and saying, yeah, and I'll sign off on what you say too, in which case it comes off as more condescending. So I think it depends on your frame of reference. It's an interesting point, but I think Malbim is probably looking at it from the Golos perspective, as opposed to we've already made it perspective. Good. So take a look now, please, at Pasuk Chav Dalet, sentence 24. He has already given the right to return, right of return. He has already given money, resources, and told them they could bring it. He has already given them a pledge to support their karbanos, their offerings. And now he says in Pasuk Chav Dalet, sentence 24, Ulachom mahodin, you are all informed. Dichol kahanaya v'leivaye zamaraya taraaya nisinaya ufalche beis elaka dina. All of the kohanim, levim, singers, gatekeepers, the nisinim we talked about back in Perek Bet, right? The descendants of those who worked for the Beis HaMikdash, and all who do work in this house of God, minda v'lo v'halach la shalit lemirme aleihom. Minda below v'halach is something we talked about already a few chapters ago. These are different types of royal taxes, and they are exempt. You work for the temple, you're exempt from royal taxation. Huh, that's a nice deal. The Dad Mikra says something interesting. If you take a look on your sheet in number 7, I brought it there. Fitting in with the idea that this is a royal institute. Im ha-mikdash hu mosad mamlachti. If, in fact, the Beis HaMikdash is a royal institution, Harei min hadin hu shekol ha'ovdim bo yechashvu kipigidei ha'melech. So it makes sense that all who serve there shall be considered royal servants. Ha'pturim mitashlumim b'shibudim ha'mutalim ha'shara toshavim. And they'll be exempt from all the payments that, and obligations that are incumbent upon the rest of the population. Takana zu hafcha b'meshach hazman l'nohag shekol ha'moshlim ba'asya u'be'eropa kibluhu. And that became standard practice in Asia and Europe. Exempting the Kohanim and those who serve from the yoke of the king. And of course, this reminds us of what story from Chumash?
Mitzrayim,
right? Yosef and the lands of the priests versus everybody else's land. Good. So this is a decree exempting them. And by the way, very interestingly, the Rashba, it's Chelek Aleph Tshuva Pei Dalet, sees here an exemption for Talmidei Chachamim from taxes. He bases it on what happens here in Ezra. They are the ones who are now serving, so to speak, in the house of Hashem. Before anyone disagrees, I'm going to go further. Pasuk Chav Hei, sentence number 25. Ve'ant Ezra, and you Ezra, kechachmas elakach dividach, according to the wisdom of your God in your hand, many shoftin v'dayonin dilehevon donin l'chol ama diba avar nahara l'chol yadei dasei alakach v'dila yada tehodu'un. In addition to everything else he's already given, he says, according to the wisdom of your God that is in your hand, I want you to appoint shoftim v'dayonim. What are shoftim and dayonim? Judges. Judges, right? I want you to appoint judges. The difference between a shofet and a dayan in general, we would just assume that these are two different terms, maybe reflecting different levels in a hierarchy, and maybe even not. The Malbim characteristically wants to find a distinction, and so he says that shoftim are experts, and dayanim are lower level. They're not necessarily as expert as the ones on the higher level. You have a hierarchy of courts. So he says, or first the king says, appoint these judges. They will judge the nation that's in your region, the other side of the Yarden, for all who know the laws of your God, and those who don't know, teach them. Or as Malbim reads it, your first level judge, or your higher level judge, the Shofet, is those who know the law of your God, and those who don't know are the lower level ones. Maybe. Either way, most of the Mefarshim read it the first way, appoint judges for Torah law, and to teach those who don't know the laws of the Torah. Finally, last sentence in this, V'chol dila lehevei aved dasa di elakach. And anybody who's not going to fulfill the law of your God, v'dasa di malka, and the law of the king, by the way, asparna dina lehevei misaved minei. Let them judge and punish that person quickly. Hein lemos, whether that means death, hein, or whether it means lishroshi, is what it appears to, yeah, hein lishroshi. Literally, lishroshi would mean to uproot. The Gemara Moikatan says it means to excommunicate. Hein la'anosh nichsin v'la esurin, or whether it means in terms of punishing the person financially, or esurin, which means, prison. Prison. All of these different powers are given by the king to Ezra. One thing we're going to have to watch for is, so when does Ezra use them? When does Ezra actually implement the authority he's been given? But you realize now what I meant when I said this is a remarkably generous decree. It started out with what we were already familiar with. Permission to go, Cyrus did that. Funding, all right, so Cyrus did that, Darius did that, maybe there's a little more here, possibly. Okay, but he also has the power to appoint judges. He also has the power to punish. This is, for all intents and purposes, he's running the show. Yes?
It's curious because the king slips something in at the end.
The law of the king also.
Yeah, up until now it's been your law, religious law, religious law, you're my guy. And while you're my guy, you're also the magistrate for civil Persian law.
Yep, you're right. That's there too.
And how does Ezra deal with conflicts between those two sets of law?
Well, the way he's going to deal with conflicts between the two sets of law is that he's actually not going to do any of this. That's why I made the comment of, let's see where he does this. It's not Ezra's way. And that's a very important piece because it's one of the key distinguishing characteristics between Ezra and Nehemiah. If Nehemiah gets these rights, he's all over it.
Right.
That's what Nehemiah does. Ezra is a very different leader. So we'll see that as we go through it. Even in the next parak, we're gonna see that. But what we're very clearly seeing is the statement that everything is going to be under Ezra's control if he wants it. So says the government. Okay. And then we get, closing the parak with the last two psukim, Ezra's thanks to Hashem. Pasuk Chaf Zion, sentence 27, we're at the bottom of page 1829. He says, and here we shift into first person without warning. Remember, Ezra wrote the book, but we haven't had Ezra speaking until now because he hasn't been there. He only showed up in Parak Zion. So now, Baruch Hashem Elokei Avoseinu, blessed is God, the God of our ancestors, Asher Nasan Kazos Belev HaMelech, who put this into the heart of the king, Lefa'er Es Beis Hashem Asher B'Yerushalayim, to glorify or to make beautiful the house of God in Jerusalem. Ve'alai Hitach Chesed Lifnei HaMelech V'Yoatzav, and Hashem gave me favor in the eyes of the king and his advisors, U'lechol Sarei HaMelech HaGiborim, and all the mighty officers of the king, Va'ani Hischazakti, and I gathered my strength, kiyad Hashem Elokai alai, in accord with the hand of God upon me. Again, that kiyad Hashem, that's the third time in this parak that we've specifically said all of this is kiyad Hashem. Vo'ek bitzami Yisrael rashim la'alos imi, and I gathered leaders to come to the land with me. This is one of those cases in which the breakup of the prakim that the church did doesn't really serve the text. Because if you look at the very next pasuk, which is chapter 8, sentence 1, and here are the leaders. Right? Which it just said at the end of pasuk Chavchet, I gathered leaders. Why are you breaking the parak here? It makes no sense. But they did it, and we got stuck with it. It's just the way it goes.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
Where does this negative perspective on our Shasta come? We see that Ezra is blessing what happened. Even doing something so that his family doesn't come to harm is not exactly
correct.
May not be the highest level of serving God, but it's pretty, you know, it's recognizing God and recognizing his power. And
right. So the answer is it doesn't have to be negative, that we don't have to view what's going on as negative. I go back to what we said the first time we saw the king being generous to us. And we asked the question of, so why is he being so nice? And we saw that Gemara. And we said part of it is, part of our suspicion is just our experience. In other words, generally speaking, governments have not been kind to us unless they had something to gain. So that's part of what this is about. You know, the governments who took us in after we were expelled from Spain and Portugal, generally speaking, did so because they were hoping for what we would bring there financially. And it worked out well for them. But that's part of it. Part of it is the textual issue in the Gemara where the things shift, Nisan and Tishrei, but I think it's much more philosophical of why would they be helping? And it's characteristic of the way we look at human events in Tanakh in general to say, God must be manipulating this. He wouldn't really have done this himself. It must be Hashem's hand that is helping at this point. Yeah?
Isn't there another element that we're kind of forgetting is that the Jews have been described as a very troublesome people
yep.
in previous documents. And it seems to me that wisely, the king has chosen a prominent Jew to represent him in this mm-hmm. environment with the hope that he will be loyal to the king.
It's an interesting point, especially if I take the view that Perek Dalet occurred where Perek Dalet is located. And it's not transplanted from later on. You still have to explain to me why Perek Dalet is talking about the walls of Yerushalayim instead of the Beis HaMikdash. But various Mepharshim had no problem with that whatsoever. So yes, if I read it that the Samaritans have already sent back a letter saying these Jews are going to rebel, then maybe this is our Tachshasta thinking to himself, here's a better way to keep them from rebelling as opposed to having to, you know, to send a whole bunch of troops and quash them that way. Or recall them all to Persia where they could be rabble-rousers there.
It would neither be the first time or the last time.
Correct. The other point that I would make here within this display of generosity, but on the other hand, control, is the question of why it is that we don't read the, I wouldn't say Hallel on Purim, right? Remember the Gemara asks the question of why we don't say Hallel on Purim? So there are a few different answers that are floated in the Gemara. One answer is that the Book of Esther counts as Hallel. Another one is because it's a miracle outside of Israel, right? Even though the other things we say Hallel for tend to be, right, today, notwithstanding. But generally speaking, the reason why we say Hallel is because, oh, I don't know, we got out of Egypt. We got the Torah in the Midbar. We sat in Sukkot in the Midbar. And the answer is once you get into the land, only miracles that happen in the... Okay, fine. But the other answer that the Gemara mentions is Akati Avdeach Hashverosh Anan. Even after the miracles of Purim, the bottom line is we are still servants of Achashverosh. And even after Ezra shows up in the land with all of this power and all of this benevolence, we're still Avdei Artachshasta. We're still working for Artachshasta. At the end of the day, this is still called the exile of Persia to some extent, even as we have a Beis Hamikdash, even though we have a temple. And that's something that I think is worth recognizing. So what we've seen today is the decree that is given in support of Ezra and in support of the Jews who have returned. What I think I really want to take away from it is this remarkable benevolence comes with becoming known as a royal institution, as that Migra suggests. But it gives Ezra remarkable powers, which, as I said, he's not even going to use. That's not who he is. It's not his style. So what we'll see next time, because I know you're waiting for this, in Parakhes, is a name list, another list of people who came back. We are not going to spend as much time on this list as we did in Parak Bet, but we'll see that. We'll see the Kohanim and Leviim, or the Kohanim and lack of Leviim, because that's a highlight of Parakhes as well. And then Ezra's great prayer, and more about the Beis HaMikdash and the journey and so forth. So that, God willing, will be in Parakhes next week. Thank you very much. And I think there are blue and white pretzels around here. Thank you, Tova, for providing. And Chag Sameach.